Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the March 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. There'll be an exception to that over the next 2 weeks as Joy LeClaire, host of Forthright Radio, and I have traded Wednesdays, which means I'll be back again with you on March 20th next week, while Joy will be hosting Forthright Radio on March 27th. Today, we are just 6 days short of the 10th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. That war, besides claiming the lives of over 5,000 U.S. soldiers, resulted in the deaths of between 120,000 and 1.5 million Iraqis, depending on whose estimate you believe, with hundreds of thousands more wounded and over 2 million made refugees. Their existence and their suffering, which, like the statistics about Iraqi deaths, were ignored by the U.S. military occupiers, the Bush administration, and the embedded mainstream media during that war. But their number far exceeded those who have fled across the border to escape the fighting from Syria these past 2 years. For the Iraqis, however, the war is far from over. With deaths from bombings occurring almost every day, the legacy of America's criminal misadventure in that country is a country divided by sectarian strife with no end in sight and forced to live with the largest U.S. embassy on the planet. Adding to that legacy are the tens of thousands of U.S. military personnel, men and women wounded and permanently maimed, physically and mentally, 18 of whom on the average choose to end their lives by suicide each and every day. And what are those responsible for this litany of crimes against humanity, against the people of Iraq, and against the women and men of the U.S. military? What has happened to them? We all know the answer. Nothing. While acknowledging that the U.S. went to war on cooked information about Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, the craven Democrats, who were put in the White House and Congress by a nation tired of war, ran and hid, led by a president who insisted that America look forward, not backward, and he was joined by Congress in doing so. The International Criminal Court obviously is not about to try Americans or its allies, such as Britain or Israel, for war crimes, and with the exception of the Serbs, it seems to exist only to punish those African politicians and warlords who are not protected by Washington's imperial shield. There is, however, one American who is being punished for what he did during the war. His name is Bradley Manning. An Army private first class, he became so outraged at what he saw his country and countrymen doing in Iraq that he turned over a critical video and a quarter of a million less than top security U.S. government cables to WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. Writes Bill Blum, a former Takes on the World guest, Bradley Manning has the charge of aiding the enemy hanging over his head, and this could lead to a present sentence of life in prison. As far as it can be deduced, the government believes that the documents and videos that Manning gave to WikiLeaks, which WikiLeaks then widely distributed to international media, aided the enemy and because it put U.S. foreign policy in a very bad light. Manning's attorneys, he writes, have asked the prosecution more than once for specific examples of how the enemy, whoever that may refer to in a world full of people bitterly angry at the U.S. because of any of many terrible acts carried out by U.S. government, in parentheses, has been aided by the WikiLeaks disclosures. Just how has the enemy made use of the released material to harm the United States, asked Blum? The government has not provided any such examples, probably because what really bothers Washington officials is the embarrassment they have experienced before the world resulting from the documents and videos, which indeed are highly embarrassing even to genuine war criminals, filled with violations of international law, atrocities, multiple lies to everyone, revelations of gross hypocrisy, and much more. So our splendid official, notes Blum, are considering putting Bradley Manning in prison forever simply because they're embarrassed, end quote. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Air Force veteran and conscientious objector Michael Thurman of Courage to Resist about the latest developments in the Bradley Manning case. Excuse me. And his testimony before the military court last month, which was secretly recorded and broadcast on Democracy Now! Yesterday, and is available online from the Freedom of Press Foundation. Until then, let's go on to some other news, beginning with a startling admission from Noam Chomsky that it was the neocons who were behind the Iraq War. Up to now, Professor Chomsky has been one of those claiming that the U.S. attacked Iraq for its oil, and he has been reluctant to speak about the Israel lobby and the neocons, who others, including myself, have blamed for the war. On March 1st, however, he was a guest on Your Voice Counts, a program on the online Republic Broadcasting Network hosted by Phil Turney, a member of the crew of the USS Liberty, which was attacked without warning by Israel on June 8, 1967, the fourth day of the Six-Day War, killing 34 of Turney's fellow crew members and wounding 171 more. Toward the end of the interview, Turney opened the phone to a caller, James Morris, a veteran Middle East analyst and blogger and noted gadfly to the neocons. Here's how it went.
I do have another caller on, James Morris from California. Respectfully, James, I introduce you to Professor Chomsky.
Professor Chomsky, thank you for coming on the show. Much appreciated. I had some questions for you, though, sir. You and I have met a couple of times, once in West L.A. It was right around the time the Iraq War was about to be launched, and I had mentioned JINSA to you, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the JINSA neocons, and you knew full well what that was because you responded by saying, did I hear what Woolsey, the former CIA director, had said recently on television? He's associated with JINSA and has even said that he held up the Presbyterian wing of JINSA. Now, Colin Powell has also conveyed in the biographical book about him by Karen DeYoung of the Washington Post that the JINSA crowd was in control of the Pentagon, basically. And we know that from the clean break agenda that the Iraq War was based on. My question to you is, you've been very good in being critical of Israel, but you don't like to touch on the Israel lobby influence, not only JINSA and the neocons, which are the upper echelon of the Israel lobby, but also APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, that John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt wrote about in their excellent book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And you seem to downplay that, and I even heard that just now with regard to the Republican Party. You mentioned the Christian Zionists, which I agree they have influence on the Republican Party, but not nearly the amount of influence that the neocons have. And we saw that with the Hagel nomination. It was opposed by the neoconservatives. Again, keep in mind the traditional Republicans like Brent Scowcroft, Brzezinski, who was a Democrat, of course, realists, are against this neocon hijacking of the Republican Party, yet we saw how powerful the neocons were with this Hagel nomination. They basically almost shot it down via their mouthpieces like John McCain and others. And again, let me pose the question, why do you deliberately downplay the influence of the Israel lobby, the neocons, AIPAC, and so on? And lastly,
okay, let's give them a chance to go ahead and respond to that, James. Yeah. Just got just a couple minutes, please.
Thanks for taking my call.
First of all, I agree with you completely about the neocons, but that's not AIPAC. The neocons are a mainstream force within conservative American, what's called conservative American thought. I go way back, very strongly rooted in the Reagan era and come right up to the present. And you're quite right that the neocons were they were the dominant force in the George W. Bush administration, and they pushed through the Iraq War over plenty of objections, huge public objections, even objections in the government and Congress. So sure, the neocons are tremendously important. As far as AIPAC's concerned, sure, you're right, it's a lobby. It's an ethnic lobby, has some power. But I think that Walt and Mearsheimer greatly misinterpreted its role.
While yielding on the neocons, Chomsky's placing them outside of the lobby is quite extraordinary, since so many of them have family members in Israel, and several, like Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, and David Wormser, acted both as advisors to Benjamin Netanyahu in the 90s and appointees in the Bush White House in 2001. AIPAC, which Chomsky described merely as an, quote, ethnic lobby with some power, was on full display the first weekend in March when 13,000 members and guests, including more than two-thirds of the U.S. Senate and almost two-thirds of the House, attended its annual policy convention banquet. At the close of the conference, AIPAC performed its annual roll call of those members of Congress in the audience, letting prospective donors know who among our elected legislators is faithful to their goal of helping Israel, which was the theme of the three-day affair, which was, join us because we're influential and we can help you help Israel, end quote. It is likely that even a greater percentage of both houses will demonstrate their fealty to AIPAC when they vote on two resolutions, perhaps by next week. One calls on the U.S. to support Israel militarily should it decide to attack Iran, and the other calls for yet tougher sanctions than those already in force against Tehran. Vice President Joe Biden was among the event's major speakers representing the Obama White House. After slobbering like an Irish setter over among old and new friends in the pro-Israel circuit and bragging about all the fundraisers he had done for AIPAC, Biden committed the president and the U.S. to another war for Israel, if necessary, to stop Iran's nuclear weapons program, despite any hard evidence that such a program actually exists.
It's not only in Israel's interest that Iran does not acquire a nuclear weapon. It's in the interest of the United States of America. It's simple. And as a matter of fact, it's in the interest of the entire world. Iraq's acquisition of a nuclear weapon not only would present an existential threat to Israel, it would present a threat to our allies and our partners and to the United States. And it would trigger an arms race, a nuclear arms race in the region, and make the world a whole lot less stable. So we have a shared strategic commitment. Let me make clear what that commitment is. It is to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, period. Period. End of discussion. Period. Prevent, not contain, prevent. The president has flatly stated that. And as many of you in this room have heard me say, and he always kids me about this, we'll be in the security room, and I know that Debbie Wasserman Schultz knows this because she hears it. He always says, you know, he'll turn to other people and say, as Joe would say, he'd make fun, as Joe would say, big nations can't bluff. Well, big nations can't bluff. And presidents of the United States cannot and do not bluff. And President Barack Obama is not bluffing. He is not bluffing.
It would be nice to hear Vice President Joe Biden say even once that he is the Vice President of the United States and not Israel. I'm not holding my breath. Democratic House Whip Steny Hoyer, whose homages to Israel I've played for you before, genuflected no less this time, reassuring the delegates that, quote, America and Israel cannot leave any uncertainty in the minds of those who describe us as their common foes, end quote. Then he went overboard. America's ties with Israel run far deeper than matters of security and statecraft, he told the applauding crowd. The United States, a young nation, and Israel, heir to an ancient birthright, were founded on the same values. These are the principles of human dignity and basic justice first laid out in the Torah and embraced by America's founders. No, Congressman, what they share is what they were both founded on ethnic cleansing and complete disregard for the peoples whose lands they stole and still occupy, and that they are God's chosen. Well, I've said it before and it bears repeating. If there is one type of behavior that describes Israel's treatment of the Palestinians under its control, it is sadistic. From the lowliest private in the Israeli occupation forces to the prime minister. What other word than sadistic can better describe the Israeli soldiers who sprayed Palestinian homes in the village of Nabi Salah with raw sewage as a punishment for organizing weekly nonviolent protests against the apartheid wall built on their stolen land? Israeli human rights watchdog B'Tselem published a video showing Israel's armored tanker trucks fitted with water cannons spraying the foul fluid at Palestinian protesters. B'Tselem said in a statement that the Israeli forces also targeted all the houses of the village with the sewage, breaking windows and, not surprisingly, causing considerable damage inside the houses. The supposedly non-lethal weapon has been added to the Israelis' armory for crowd control, said B'Tselem, even though the video shows clearly that it was used against Palestinian property. The Israeli military, it says, has been looking for an alternative to tear gas canisters for crowd control because it claims the Palestinians have learned how to cope with tear gas and its effects. 6 weeks after its election, Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu has formed a new government in what Haaretz political writer Aleph Ben described as, quote, an unadulterated victory for the right. Now the game has ended and real life will begin, writes Ben. The third Netanyahu government has one clear goal, enlarging the settlements and achieving the vision of a, quote, a million Jews living in Judea and Samaria, end quote, referring to the West Bank. This magic number will thwart the division of the land and prevent once and for all the establishment of a Palestinian state. The defense and housing and construction ministries that are relevant to this issue will be given to Likud member of the Knesset Moshe Yaalon and HaBayit HaYehudi member of the Knesset Uri Ariel, both of whom are very pro-settlement, I should interject. They won't be assuming these positions in order to freeze settlement construction, continues Ben, but rather to implement the Levy Report, which determined that Israel was not legally speaking an occupying power in the West Bank, and that HaBayit HaYehudi platform, or in other words, to gradually absorb the West Bank into Israel. Netanyahu's key task will be buying some quiet on the Palestinian issue to permit the expansion of the settlements at the small price of international condemnation. And Ben goes on, he will continue with the successful ploy from his previous term, threatening an attack on Iran and Syria, which are drawing American attention. Barack Obama, he notes, is busy with calming the Iranian front and preventing an eruption in and around Syria, and is ignoring Israel's actions in the territories. This, for Harus says out of Ben, is a deal that Netanyahu will strive to achieve with Obama during their meetings next week in Jerusalem, end quote. As a concession to the visiting American president, Netanyahu has banned settler housing tenders being issued for the West Bank and East Jerusalem when Obama visits, according to Ma'ariv newspaper. Netanyahu said the suspension does not amount to a freeze in settlement construction, and that it would only be in place up until the end of Obama's trip to avoid embarrassing the American president. That's what I call considerate.